From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Congress and broken, two words that go together. Maybe they always have, they certainly do today. To many voters, it feels like it'll never change. Rich Ehrenberg knows what makes Congress work and what gets in its way better than almost anyone. He spent 34 years on the Hill as senior staff for Senators George Mitchell, Carl Levin, and Paul Tsongas. Today, he's a visiting professor in political science at Brown University. His new book, Congressional Procedure, explores one part of Congress that we often overlook, the rules. Part history, part rulebook, and part manifesto, Ehrenberg's book makes clear how these rules are about more than just formality, especially when things start to go wrong.
There's kind of a collegial atmosphere to the Senate, and then suddenly there's a battle. The gloves go flying in the air, and when that happens, it's the people who know the rules that have the advantage.
I talked with Ehrenberg about why Congress's rules matter, where Congress is headed, and how it might save itself. Rich Ehrenberg, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, I think that having read your book, I was made only more aware of how woefully uneducated I am about, or was, about how our democracy works, how our Congress works. And I have a huge and renewed and brand new, actually, appreciation for it. And I think that your book should be required reading for anyone who would like to vote.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's very kind.
I received an email just a day or two ago from a newly elected Republican congressman. I won't name him so that I don't embarrass him or anything, but never knew him. And I got an email from him and he said he's read the book twice. He's bought a copy for every member of his staff. He'd require that they're reading it, and he'll give them an exam at the end of the week.
I'm not surprised. I mean, how are people supposed to know all this stuff? But here they have a handbook. I mean, everyone in the Senate and the House should read this, not to mention every high school student or college student.
You know, unfortunately, it is aimed at trying to make what can be a thorny subject for people accessible, while at the same time being accurate. And so it's aimed at, you know, people who want to know more about how the Congress works. But you're quite right that my experience is that most members of both bodies don't know all that much about the rules of the body that they serve in. And those who do make a study of it tend to rise in influence and leadership.
Well, let's stay with that notion of rules for a minute. Rules, procedure, precedent, tradition. Why are they so important to the functioning of Congress?
Well, the way I like to put it is you think of rules and procedures, precedents inside of the Congress as being the inside form of the rule of law. And, you know, I think we all recognize the importance of that principle in a democratic system. And that really is, it's the framework within which the Congress operates. And it's what, you know, protects the interests of all members and assures that the decision-making will go on in a way that is democratic.
What made you write this book right now? Why this book and why now?
You know, one of the ways of getting back in the direction, hopefully, of the regular order is help people to understand what it is. For most people, Congress is a black box. They know what goes in on the conveyor belt. They watch that. They watch what comes out on the conveyor belt. These days, not much comes out, but when it does. But they have no idea what's going on in the black box. And this book is an effort to open up that black box, make it accessible to people. And it's my hope, and this applies to members of Congress as well, because often they don't know the rules, that if they do have more understanding and appreciation for them and what they're in fact designed to do, that, you know, that maybe we'll have a better chance of moving back towards the regular order, because what lies down that road, if it just keeps rolling, really is what we derisively call a banana republic.
You know? Wow. Was there a moment in particular when you became utterly fascinated or impelled to understand a procedure?
Well, it really was very early on for me, and part of it was my background in political science. You know, having been a graduate student, a doctoral candidate, you know, I was a participant observer to some extent, really, from the beginning. Observing senators like Robert Byrd and Richard Russell before him, you know, these were the people who really understood the rules, and it made them very effective, and in fact, feared by their colleagues. I mean, other senators were afraid of Robert Byrd.
So knowledge of procedure is
power.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because you know, I always think of the Senate kind of like a hockey game. If you're a fan of hockey, then you know that when there's going to be a fight between two players, the signal for that is the gloves go flying up into the air, because you're on ice and you're wearing thick gloves and you can't fight very effectively unless you can't get rid of the skates, so you get rid of the gloves. The Senate's kind of like that. You know, most of the time it's skating around, stuff goes on by unanimous consent, rules sometimes don't even get enforced, you know. There's kind of a collegial atmosphere to the Senate. And then suddenly there's a battle over whatever it may be, whatever the principle is.
And the gloves go flying.
The gloves go flying in the air. And when that happens, it's the people who know the rules that have mm-hmm. the advantage.
And speaking of that, you write that democracy is something more than majority rule. It also involves the protection of the rights of the minority. I actually didn't know that before I read your book. I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah.
And that I found that fascinating. And so I wonder, you know, you've written that filibuster, for example, is the soul of the Senate for precisely that reason. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, I think what has made the Senate the unique body that it is that it guarantees the minority in the Senate two very fundamental things. One is the right to offer amendments, and the other is the right to debate. And if you think about it, those are the heart of legislative protection. There's no guarantee that they can get their amendments approved or anything like that, but that in the Senate, they'll have the opportunity to offer amendments and to speak, generally speaking. This is very different than the House of Representatives, which is a majoritarian body, where the party that has the majority controls the House. And in fact, most of the time, most members of the minority in the House have very little leverage. They really don't matter in the legislative process as it goes forward in that body.
And why is it important that the minority be heard?
You know, there's an expression that I like, and that is that democracy is something more than two wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner.
That's great. Yeah. That's a really important way to think about it, I think.
And the Senate is the only place in our government that provides that opportunity. And the heart of that has been what we call the filibuster. Really what it is the guarantee that once a member of the Senate is recognized and on his feet, he can't be taken off of his feet. He can speak. You know, the popular notion of the filibuster, you know, I think all most people know about the filibuster is they saw Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes mm-hmm. to Washington. Mm-hmm. And so they think about that sort of long-winded filibuster. And you know, that's a form of doing it, but actually it's really, it could be a number of actions taken to slow down the body and keep the Senate from very quickly going to a vote to resolve the matter.
Right. So it's a consensus encouraging, consensus
Absolutely.
Building.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's played that role and as I often say to my students, the Senate is very frequently the cradle of compromise. Mm. So if you watch how compromises develop, they often begin in the Senate.
That's so.
And in fact, we just saw, a compromise appropriations bill passed to end the government shutdown after 35 days. And typically that compromise, that decision initially came out of a head-to-head meeting between Chuck Schumer and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. So it's the leaders of the two parties getting together and saying, how can we move forward? You know, I talk about in the closing chapter of this book, Congressional Procedure, I talk about what I call the weaponization of procedure.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
And well, what I mean by that is that normal procedures, what we call in the Senate, regular order. Mm-hmm.
Did John McCain?
Yeah, he did. He
coined that phrase?
No, he didn't coin it, but he invoked it.
He invoked it. Uh-huh.
And that was, really his last great speech in the Senate, when he voted against repealing Obamacare. You'll remember that, mm-hmm. his famous thumbs down situation. But McCain, he made a speech to his fellow senators, and virtually all of them were there as a show of respect for who he was. And McCain was opposed to the Affordable Care Act. He didn't like Obamacare. He was all for repealing it. What he was objecting to was that the Congress was going around the regular order to get it done. And in fact, we see this. That's what I mean by the weaponization, is that often rules are used in a way that I would describe as abusive, because they're used as weapons to take advantage of an advantage that the majority may have, or in some cases the minority might have. The overuse of the filibuster is an example of that. When I first came to the Senate, which was in 1978, every member of the Senate understood that it was restraint in the use of many of these rules that protected them for the times when you really needed them. And that explains why filibusters, although they were possible, as I said, going back, really to the origins of the Senate, were rarely used. And in fact, almost never used on a judicial nomination, which we'll come to when we talk about the nuclear option. So restraint was an important part of this. And the kind of hyper-partisan polarization that we see right now in our political environment, reflected in the Congress, reflected in the Senate, has caused really both parties to use whatever procedures they can get their hands on for advantage. And it just creates, when I talk about polarization, there's no video element of our conversation here, so nobody can see me cranking my arm, but my my students would laugh at me if they could see it, because whenever I talk about polarization, I do that because I think it is it's an action and reaction. It's almost a perpetual motion machine, mm-hmm. and that's why it's gotten worse and worse and worse.
This notion of perpetual motion machine is disturbing to me, because it makes me wonder, do you believe that at some point there is a point of no return and that something will break? Or do you still have faith in the resiliency of the Congress, which you so revere?
I do have faith in the resiliency of the institution. But frankly, I'm very concerned about that. I see this, as I say, things get more and more polarized. The abuse of the rules is a slippery slope that each time, for using, going back to the example of the nuclear option, the fact that they used it in November of 2013 made it very easy 4 years later, or 5 years later, I guess it was, for Mitch McConnell and the now Republican majority to extend it to the Supreme Court.
This might answer my next question, which is that the approval ratings for Congress are traditionally quite low.
Forever.
Yeah.
Congress, you know, I mean, Will Rogers said that there's no professional criminal class in America except for Congress. The problem that Congress has in that regard is there's 535 of them. They don't speak with one voice. And so they're an easy target for those who can, namely the president very often. You know, we talk about the president having the bully pulpit.
Right.
And he can use that. And it's very hard when the Congress goes up against him in the, you know, kind of in the world of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Often the deck is stacked against them simply because, you know, there's always, you know, multiple voices, and there's a majority and there's a minority and there's...
And depending on where you sit, someone's going to look like the obstructionist and
right.
someone else is going to look like the one who's really trying to get things done,
exactly.
I guess.
You almost exactly quoted Mandela, who said, where you sit is where you stand.
What do you see as a way forward for the mm-hmm. Senate?
Well, that's a difficult question. I'm asked that a lot, and I'm an optimist by nature. I write a lot of op-eds. I'm always trying to promote some idea or another that helps to, you know, to try to maybe turn back the clock on one of these rules. And of course, you can tell from our conversation that I'm very focused on what the nuclear option did to the filibuster rule. And in that regard, I've suggested, for example, that any time we're in a period prior to a congressional election, when it's not clear which side is going to be the majority and which side is going to be the minority in the next Congress. And with the Senate, that's most elections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's usually a credible chance that the minority is going to become the majority. And it's occurred to me that if the leadership of both parties would just kind of appoint a special committee or something like that to examine and revise the Senate's rules, that doing it in that period would help to solve one of the biggest problems, which is the majority always likes the prerogatives of the majority and the minority always likes the prerogatives of the minority. We talked about Nelson Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you stand depends on where you sit.
Mm-hmm.
It's particularly true when it comes to those kind of rule reforms.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is very similar to what the trick that virtually every parent knows. And that is, if you've got two kids and a cookie and you want to divide it fairly, you say to one kid, you cut the cookie, and the other one, you get to choose, and you get the most exquisitely divided
Fair.
Cookie of all time.
Right.
And that's the idea behind this, that if neither party knows who's likely to be in the majority or the minority, then there's no standard to go by except what's good for the Senate.
Right. Just to change tack sure. for a second, College Hill is quite a ways from Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. and you're teaching here at Brown, and you have been for, I believe, 10 years
yes.
now. What do you think you bring to teaching, and what do you get out of it?
Well, it's very interesting. When I first began talking to people about retiring from the Senate staff, and you know, I started thinking, I was on Capitol Hill for 34 years, and what do you do with that kind of expertise? Now, I always tell my students, you know, most of my colleagues did what we called going downtown. Namely,
becoming
they
lobbyists.
Went to work, became a lobbyist.
Yeah.
And I like to point out that most of them are millionaires, and I'm here teaching students. But, you know, but I say that in jest.
But
I
you mean, can sleep at night.
Yeah. Because that wasn't why I went to Washington. And that wasn't what I wanted to spend my time doing. And to me, the dream would be if a university somewhere would give me a room full of engaged, bright students who wanted to go out in the world and do something, that, you know, that would be very fulfilling for me. When I began to talk to colleagues about it, particularly friends that I had that were in academia, you know, they would say to me, virtually all of them said, oh, you don't want to do that. You know, you're used to being a big shot on Capitol Hill, and, you know, you go somewhere as an adjunct, and, you know, they probably won't take you all that seriously. And
I hope that hasn't been your experience.
That certainly, that's where I'm leading. You know, when Brown offered me the opportunity, it was very sudden. It was in around Thanksgiving of 08, and they wanted me to come and teach in January. So I had to make the decision very quickly. I hadn't planned to be deciding that at that point. But I grew up in southeastern Connecticut. I knew Brown. I knew what it represented. And I thought, you know, a better place for me is never going to come along. And I'm so thankful that I made that decision. I miss Capitol Hill every single day. And the worse things get up there, the more my juices start flowing, mm-hmm. and I want to be, you know, back in the mix. But I don't regret that decision. You know, Brown has been wonderful to me. The students are fantastic.
Have some of them gone on to work in public policy and government?
Yeah. In fact, there are a number of my former students on Capitol Hill.
So there's hope.
I like to call them the Ehrenberg Caucus.
What is one takeaway for any reader of your book, student or senator or staffer? What's one takeaway that you would want someone to have from this book?
Well, clearly, I would want them to understand that procedure matters. But even more broadly than that, I hope that they would take away from the things that I've written this book and the prior book about the filibuster, an appreciation for the Senate as an institution and how valuable it is to our democracy. And that's my day one speech in all of my classes to all of my students is, you know, I know you come into this room, like most Americans, with a pretty minimal respect for the Congress. I hope, if nothing else, by the end of the semester, you'll come out of it with at least respect for the institution.
Well, I would like to make this a signed reading for all Trending Globally listeners. Congressional Procedure by Richard Ehrenberg. And thank you so much, Rich, for coming in to talk to us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards, Babette Thomas, and John Mazza. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Trending Globally.